Hello, and welcome to Plot Trysts. This is Meg. Today's episode is part of our limited series, My Word is Vorkosigan. These episodes deviate a bit from our regular Plot Trysts format. I'm not hosting them with Lane, but rather with historical romance author and fellow Lois McMaster Bujold superfan Alexandra Vasti. Instead of short, digestible book reviews, these episodes are longer discussions of each book in the Vorkosigan Saga series, and do involve major spoilers. If you're reading along with us, please feel free to join our Discord discussion. You can find an invitation link at our website, plottrysts.wordpress.com, or at the link in our Instagram bio, at plottrysts. Today's episode covers Sita Ganda, with guest host Catherine Addison. 2024 marks the 10th anniversary of her wonderful fantasy novel, The Goblin Emperor. Hello, and welcome back to another special edition of Plot Trysts, My Word as Vorkosigan. Today, we're going to be talking about Sita Ganda, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Alexandra Vasti.
Hi, I'm Alexandra Vasti, and I write historical romance.
And today, we are so excited to have Catherine Addison with us. She's the author of The Goblin Emperor. And hi, Catherine.
Hello.
All right, Catherine, we were wondering if you could start off by telling us a little bit about how you came to the Vorkosigan Saga, what your relationship is with the series.
I have been reading Vorkosigan books for a really long time. I honestly can't remember quite when I started or how I started. My best guess is that I started in college, which was 92 to 96. So, been reading them for a really long time. Love the world, love the writing. Want to strangle Miles, as one does.
Yes, yes, but you also love him. Yes, yeah. A lovable strangling.
Yes.
But today we're talking about Sita Ganda. This was published in 1995, so kind of an interesting placement for this one. So if you're looking at it chronologically, it comes towards the beginning of the saga, but its publication date puts it after Brothers in Arms and Mirror Dance. So it was published after Mirror Dance, but chronologically it comes after the Vor Game, but before Ethan of Athos. So this is one of the interesting things that Bujold does or has done is she'll write almost like episodic entries into the series where you can go back. She explores maybe what happened to Miles when he was younger. And I don't know, I think it's interesting to read the book knowing when it was written as opposed to when it falls in the series because of some of the psychological insights I think you get into some of the characters. But I just wanted to point that out.
I totally agree. And I also feel like after, right, like Mirror Dance and Memory are both very intense, very heavy books. And Sita Ganda is a romp. And, you know, for me, if I was writing one incredibly, you know, rough, angsty book, like taking a romp break, I could see that being something that I found psychologically necessary.
Yeah.
Let me give our summary of Sita Ganda. So this is coming right after the Vor Game. Miles and Ivan are sent to Sita Ganda. They are going to the homeworld of the Sita Ganda Empire to represent Beriar at the funeral of the former Empress Elizabeth, who has died. This funeral is this enormous state production, and immediately, like before they even dock, you know, they're enwrapped in this plot, which Miles kind of takes over. And so the plot is that they, Aba, which is a sort of genetically created race on Sita Ganda that has no gender. So the Ba rushes their spaceship. They get some kind of artifact from the Ba. Miles decides to investigate what this artifact is. Doesn't, of course, inform his superior officers because that's Miles's way. And eventually finds out that this artifact is meant to be an important part of the Cetagandan genome, like the code for the Cetagandan genome. He is confronted by a Haute woman, and the Haute are one of the, they're sort of like the superior race on Cetaganda, a Haute woman named Ryan Degtyar, who is the handmaiden of the Star Crash. She is in charge of the Cetagandan, specifically the Haute genome. And she says, that's my artifact, that's my great key, I need it. And it turns out it's fake. So there's clearly been some kind of plot to steal this key and blame the theft on the Beriarans. Miles decides to figure this out himself in order to avoid a galactic incident between Cetaganda and Beriar. The Ba is found dead in a framed suicide. And so basically, you know, the rest of the book is a mystery plot. We have suspects, we have clues. Miles tries to stir things up. There are several interesting events in which Miles and Ivan are threatened in various more and less serious ways, some of which are very funny. And ultimately, Miles solves the mystery of the Great Key, and that one of the governors of one of the Cetagandan satrapies, one of their sort of like satellite planets, has been trying to kind of steal this for himself. Miles solves this in kind of an exciting last stand alongside one of the or some of the Haute women, and then Miles gets this medal, the Cetagandan Order of Merit, at the end of the book, is very comical. So that's the mystery romp of Cetaganda, set on Cetaganda.
Yeah, and when I contacted Catherine to see if she would be willing to be on one of our episodes, she chose Cetaganda. So that you had the choice of several books, and you were like, you know what, I think I will go with Cetaganda. And do you want to talk about like why you wanted to talk about this one? Or
sure, there are two reasons. One of which is that I'm very fond of this book. I enjoy it very much. I love young Miles and young Ivan getting in trouble in the middle of a state funeral.
Yes.
It's a wonderful book. But also, and especially I noticed this when I was rereading it for this episode, that the Cetagandan Empire and the way that the emperor functions in it is kind of a big influence for the Goblin Emperor. I was really struck by how much my back brain had sort of internalized how the Cetagandan Empire works. The Empire of the Athuvaras in the Goblin Emperor does not work the same way, but the central figure of the Emperor and what the Emperor can do and what the Emperor can't do, which is an important part of this book, turned out to be a really important part of my book.
So many of Bujold's books are just a really interesting investigation into power and who has power and how is power, you know, held, and what is it, you know, so you're okay, great, you're in this position of power, what do you actually have the power to do and enact and accomplish? And one of the things I love about this book is how over and over and over again Miles' assumptions about Cetaganda and how Cetaganda society works are like turned on their heads, right? Like he meets Ryan Degtyar and he's like, oh, she's the handmaiden. she must be like, you know, and he realizes, like, of course she must have been important, but he doesn't realize, like, really until the end pretty much of the book, that like she's the acting empress of Cetaganda. She has an incredible amount of power, and he's constantly trying to figure out, how does this work? So in Cetagandan society, there's the Haute, who are, you know, at the top of the society, and they are genetically modified. They're constantly playing with their own genome in order to, you know, get the things, the qualities in themselves that they want. Then below them in the totem pole are the Gem, and the Gem are kind of the military leaders. They can be gifted a Haute wife if they perform, you know, the male Gem can be gifted a Haute wife if they perform well. They get like a Haute, you know, lady present. Which we see, we see how that plays out. Like, not all of the Haute ladies are happy about being ousted from their society. And then we have the Ba. So there's a lot of different levels, and Miles is constantly trying to figure out how these levels work together. You know, in Miles' mind, the Gem, the military people, he's like, why aren't they in charge? You know, in his mind, that's the only kind of power that he really can conceive of.
Yeah. Well, and it's all, I mean, he comes from an empire too. So he's like, well, it must work the same way as the Beri Arran Empire. There's the emperor, and then there are the Vor. And then, yeah, we have planets. It's the same thing. And it takes him a while to realize it's not exactly the same.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that rereading it, I really quite enjoyed was the way that the Beri Arran Empire fails to map onto the Seed of Ganden Empire.
Yes.
That again and again, Miles is thrown for a loop because it doesn't work the way he thinks it does.
Yeah, so the Hoat women are so interesting to me. So the Hoat women, when we first meet them, they're in bubbles. They're literally in bubbles. It's so great. I mean, Bujold is like, I just love how she like leans into things. She's like, I'm going to come up with the idea of bubbles, and then I'm going to make it like sci-fi accurate, where we're going to talk about how these bubbles are constructed and what weapons they can, you know, like fend off. Anyway, so the Hoat women travel around in bubbles. They're on a anti-grav chair, a float chair that floats around, and then the bubble, the chair has around it a force bubble that is not just, you know, repels weapons, but also is opaque. So they can make it unopaque if they want to, but generally these women float around in an opaque bubble. They are completely veiled. They can't be seen. And Miles, it's so great. Miles is like, oh, they're in their pajamas. You know, it's like, what are they doing in there? But in his mind, you know, I think he thinks that these Hoat women are, you know, hyper protected, and, you know, that in some ways they're like sort of the ultimate like Vor Blossom, who is fragile and sheltered and whatever. But in fact, you know, as we learn slowly over the course of the book, these Hoat women are in charge of a lot.
Yes. I mean, you could say that they're in charge of the thing that the Hoat value.
Right, which is the genome.
More than anything else, which is
exactly.
The genome.
Yes.
And so they're all geneticists, which is something that I love, because it just completely upends what Miles thinks is going on, is that these are not fragile, sheltered, decorative women, even though they're fantastically beautiful. They're geneticists. They're scientists. And it just doesn't work the way it looks like it works.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes. And when he realizes that, one of the things I like too is when he finally figures out that the Hoat are not the same as the Empire, and that they have different goals, and that, yes, the Emperor is in charge of the Empire, but he's not in charge of the Hoat. That's
right.
I think it's really well done too, because it comes out as he's figuring out the other mystery. So it's like these two mysteries that you discover at the same time.
Right.
It's just great. Like we end up every time we record, we just end up saying, well, it's just really good. Bujold's such a good writer.
Bujold's, you know, so smart. Yeah, every episode.
But it's true. You know,
it is true.
Yeah. So can we talk a little bit about Ivan, because
I was
to
going
me,
to say
wonderful. He's like the highlight of this book for me. I was thinking this time, thinking about when it was published and when it falls chronologically. When I first read the series, I read this in chronological order, and this was the first book where I started to appreciate Ivan, because in previous books, he's the sidekick, he's the idiot, right? Ivan, you idiot. And he doesn't seem to have more character than that. He just follows what Miles does. And, you know, he doesn't seem like he's a mean person, but he doesn't seem like much else either.
He doesn't have a lot of interiority.
Yes. And here he really starts to come into his own as a character. And I really love that you see, sure, he goes along with Miles, but it's not because he doesn't have ideas of his own.
It's because he's been going along with Miles his entire life.
Right.
Even though it gets him in trouble time and time again.
Yeah.
He continues to follow Miles.
We're in Miles' POV. So I think sometimes I kind of like get seduced by Miles' POV and I'm like, sure, that makes sense. You know, like, okay, yeah, you should do that. And then Ivan is so helpful in this book. He's like, we've been here 3 days. When did we get put in charge of Seed again and Imperial Security? Like, what? Why is this your job, Miles? You know, he's very helpful in contextualizing Miles so we don't get swept away. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, Miles is very sweeping, right? And so seeing Ivan in this one kind of push back a little bit against some of Miles's sweepiness, whatever word I'm looking for there, it definitely lets us see Ivan as more of kind of an autonomous character here.
Yeah, and it gives us a different perspective on Miles because the books that come before it in terms of when she wrote them are very much about Miles being sweeping. That's what Miles does. That's what the books are for. And this book is not quite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's an interesting pair with Memory.
Yes.
Which is also a great Ivan book.
Yeah, it is.
But that where you see, we see limits on what Miles can do. And limits on how, you know, he's not omniscient and he's not always one step ahead in Seed Aganda. He's frequently one step behind.
Yes. Well, and I think, Alex, you were saying in our notes that you kind of start to see that forward momentum doesn't always serve Miles the way he thinks it does. Right.
Yeah. There's a part where Ivan is kind of questioning him and he gets mad at Ivan and he is mad at Ivan kind of undermining him. And he thinks even a momentary loss of concentration, of self-confidence, of forward momentum could be fatal. And it's, you know, I think we really see like the cracks in Miles, who in Warrior's Apprentice and in War Game, whatever Miles does works, you know, he like, it seems, you know, bananas and it shouldn't work, and yet somehow he manages to, you know, take back the Dondarrion in his slippers. You know what I mean? He just always succeeds. And so I think that this is where we're starting to see those cracks, and that Miles isn't always going to be, you know, on top.
You know, I do. So I love Ivan in this book. I do feel bad for him because he always seems to be the butt of the joke. So I love the slutty ale, for example. Every time I read that scene, it cracks me up every single time.
Okay, so for anyone who hasn't read this book, the scene is basically there are these sort of enemies who are trying to kind of frame Beriar and kind of do various things to Miles and Ivan. And they're being run through this kind of hapless Lord Yanaro, the CDN and Lord Yanaro. And so they're at a party at Yanaro's house, and Yanaro gives Ivan this zloty ale, this beverage, and Miles like, absolutely not. There's no way I'm gonna, you know, consume that. But you know what Ivan sort of does, and so Ivan vanishes upstairs with two gorgeous gem women, gorgeous, sexy, you know, ladies. Comes down later and is like, I've been poisoned, and so. What has happened to Ivan in this with the zloty ale is that he's been given some kind of drug that has caused him not to be able to achieve an erection. And his way of dealing with this is he invents, you know, the Seed Aganda kind of think the Beriarans are like hicks.
Barbarians, right?
Yeah, right. And so he's like, I came up with this like barbarian folklore off the top of my head that on Beriar it was rude for a man to, you know, achieve sexual climax until the woman had three times. And so he has these two women with him and he has to make both of them come three times. And he describes this process until they both fall asleep. And then he's like, but they fell asleep smiling. And it is so funny. And he's horrified by this. But then the upshot is that all the women in Seed Aganda gossip, and you know, he's like sort of afraid, what are they going to gossip about? But the gossip, I guess, is that he's an incredible lover. and then for the whole rest of the book, he's inundated by these invitations. Women who want to get him in bed. Yeah.
Yes. I always imagine too, like any other barrier and visitor to Seed Aganda, like after that.
Oh my God. Never thought about that before.
Like, what's going to happen? You know? But yeah, so there's that. He also finds these kittens. So they go to like a plant show, I guess. It's not a garden party. They go to a genetic show where people have created these plants. And showing off their
science projects, basically.
Yes. Some of them sing, some of them smell really good. And Ivan finds this plant that is growing kittens. And he's like, it's a kitten tree. Yes. And he's just horrified. And he's like, this for me was the moment where I was like, I really like Ivan. Cause he's like, I need to rescue these kittens. So he takes down this kitten fruit. And unfortunately, it's not actually a kitten, right? So he cannot rescue these kittens, but he's just like morally outraged by this hybrid kitten tree. And it's like one of the sweetest, saddest things that Buchholz has written for me.
I find the kitten tree is one of the more disturbing images that just sticks with me, because I thought, ooh, Sita Ganda, Miles and Ivan, state funeral. And I thought, oh, the kitten.
Yes, the kittens.
Yeah, it's definitely like kind of a moment of like black humor, I think, for Buchholz. Yes. Because it's terrible, right? Because the kitten dies and Ivan has this like little kitten corpse, you know.
And they have to dispose of the corpse as well, like hide it.
I mean, it's terrible and it's sort of comical. And we see Ivan's like, as exactly as you said, Mike, his kind of like moral outrage. Yeah, this is definitely the book. Okay, so I'm a romance writer. So this is the book where Ivan like becomes a romance hero for me. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, Ivan, I see you. I'm, you know, you're not just like the bumbling sidekick. You are a hero in your own right. And then it, you know, takes a while for him to get his story, but he does.
Yeah. And then there's another part later that I, with Ivan. So Miles just, it's the very end of the book and he just takes off and goes like onto an enemy ship to just like, you know, rescue everyone and figure everything out. And he leaves Ivan like drugged on the floor, like being treated by these Hope women. And then he comes and he kind of saves Miles. And he says, Miles, what were you thinking leaving with no backup? And Miles says, well, you were my backup and you worked really well. And that to me also was just like very, very nice, like this really nice cousinly relationship finally, because you also see a lot of times Miles just really, I mean, the reason you think Ivan, you idiot, is because Miles thinks Ivan, you idiot all the time.
Yes.
But you actually see that Miles does rely on him. So I like it.
Yes, Ivan has this like sneaky confidence, right? Like he's constantly trying to not be, and we get some, you know, Cordelia level like bait analysis of Ivan later in the series, but basically, you know, Ivan is constantly trying to stay out of the limelight and he kind of performs incompetence a lot for whatever reason. And so Miles is an expert in personnel, right? Miles, I think, does know deep down that Ivan is competent, that Ivan, you know, will be able to do what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. I think Miles uses Ivan and Ivan uses Miles, that it really does go both ways. Because if Ivan's standing next to Miles, nobody's looking at Ivan.
Yeah. That's
right.
True. Such a good point.
They have a wonderful like brotherly sort of relationship with the, you know, the love and the affection, but also kind of the rivalry and the like, they're constantly like, you know, giving each other a hard time, right? She does a great job characterizing the relationship between them in a way that feels really real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely agree.
I would read a lot of like Adventures of Young Miles and Ivan. They don't need to have a larger overarching plot. Like, no, I would just read like 15 episodic like things Ivan and Miles did.
Yeah.
On the note of overarching plot, like one question I had about this actually is like, I guess I'm not totally sure how it fits in with the board game, because the board game ends with, you know, Gregor is going to like take the Dondarrion more seriously and make them part of, you know, his thing. And Miles is going to be Admiral Naismith. Like, that's how the board game ends. And then we are like, suddenly, like, they're on Cetaganda. I always feel like, well, how did this happen? Like, does this, I don't know. Like, why are they, I don't know. I have questions about the overarching plot of like how they ended up on Cetaganda in the first place.
My guess, or my hand wave, either way, is that Gregor needed a precisely calibrated set of people to send to the funeral. Very precisely calibrated. Mm. And Miles and Ivan are that very precisely calibrated. We're not insulting you because we're sending you Vor, but we're sending you guys in their early 20s.
Right.
Who have no power and do nothing important. They're just poor lordlings. And I mean, that's my guess.
Yeah. Well, and also both related to
Gregor.
So yes. You're right. You can't say they're not important. But I mean, Miles's whole cover, at least the one that he puts out in this book, is that he's got this job as an IMSEC courier because he's really not good for much else.
Right.
Right. So. Yeah, that's a really great hand wave. If that's what
yeah,
it is.
No, that is good. And it's interesting too to think about then who, so this is like jumping way ahead, so sorry. But in A Civil Campaign, where in the epilogue, we get Gregor and Lisa's wedding. So I'm just kind of like, minor spoiler, guys, I'm sorry, Gregor gets married. It happens one of the later books, small spoiler. But who the Cetagandans send as their representatives to Gregor and Lisa's wedding. Right. Yes. So we get so it's actually, I think that's a great like reasoning, because it, I would say it's fairly, I don't want to spoil A Civil Campaign. Not that that's a major plot point, but I don't want to spoil this incredibly minor moment in this book. But I think it does parallel well who they choose to send as their representatives to the Imperial wedding.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the Hote. So there are two major Hote women characters. One is the Hote Rian or Ryan Degtyar. It's really difficult for me because I have listened to this book more than I've read it. I don't know if I would pronounce them the same if I had just read it. But anyway, so we have Ryan Degtyar.
Yeah, she's right. Robert Gardner pronounces it Ryan, and therefore. Yeah. That's how it is in
that's
my mind.
That's how it that is in
first,
my head now.
Yeah. My first encounter with all the books was the audio. So
yes. So she is the handmaiden of the Starkresh, which is a much higher rank than Miles realizes at first. And he falls helplessly in love with her. The moment he sees her face, he's just now in love with Ryan. And she's the one who
falls to his knees and like crawls to her.
Like literally.
Like the most Miles drama.
Yes. And the entire time he's like, oh, she sees me as just a cockroach. I'm nothing. You know? I could never aspire to touch her hand. But so we have Ryan who has lost the key to the Starkresh, and he aligns himself with her so that they can try to find it. And then one of her allies is the Hote Pell. And so Pell is a little bit older. Miles thinks she's probably in her 80s, but she looks like she's in her 40s. And she is the most adventurous Hote lady that we meet. So he meets her for the first time, and she lets him come in her Hote bubble. And he sits on the armrest, and then she just like jumps over the edge of this balcony. And she's such a great character, in my opinion, because we've got, again, like we talked about at the beginning, we've got this view of the Hote women as being very fragile. We're starting to understand that actually they're not fragile or protected, but then the Hote Pell is the one who's actually like very action oriented. And I just really like that we get these two different Hote woman characters.
Yeah, and Pell, I feel like, doesn't get a ton of on-page time, and yet she's very, sort of very wonderfully characterized in those few pages that she's there. The Hote women are, that we, you know, Ryan and Pell both are very practical. They're very smart. They're great female characters, even if their concerns are maybe a little unsettling to us, right? Like they're talking about how do we genetically alter the gem to make them more controllable? And is that really a good idea? You know, and like, right. We're like, oh, those are not good things we're thinking. But they're still very appealing female characters, I think, because they're really badass, basically.
Yeah. Well, and I noticed this time that what Miles thinks Ryan is doing to him is exactly what he is doing to her, mm-hmm. because he falls in love with her face. He sees her face and he's gone. And it has nothing to do with Ryan herself. And it's exactly the same way that he keeps thinking, well, see me for me, not for my body. And well, Miles, practice what you preach, buddy.
Exactly. But this is another part of the book where Ivan shines. It's a throwaway line, but he talks about, so he says, again, I said Miles went on his mission and left Ivan basically insensible on the ground. The Hote women, surrounded by 6 Hote women, and they revive him. And he's talking later, and he's like, yes, as soon as I got away from those ladies, then I did this. And Miles is like, well, how did you get away from those ladies? And he was like, well, they're just like my mother, only times 6. And so it really feels like Ivan is the one who's seeing them as actual women and actual people. He's not immediately bowled over by how attractive they are. And of course they're beautiful. Of course they're wonderful, but they're just people like his mom, you know?
Right.
So
I think it's interesting though, that you bring up the way that Miles talks about how they, you know, he thinks, you know, see me for more than my body. Right. And part of that is, you know, his inherent insecurities about his body, and especially with barrier and prejudices against, you know, anyone who's physically different, but also because of what the Hote do, which is try to perfect the genome. So, you know, someone like Miles would not be what they're after. And so I think there's a lot of interesting sort of discussion in this book about like who's human, right? So Miles and Ivan have several conversations where they talk about, are the Hote even human? After all the tinkering with their genes that they've done, are they still human? Miles imagines a future, you know, generations down the line when the Hote will have, you know, achieved the ultimate, you know, genomic ideal that they're looking for. And he wonders, what will their concerns be? Will they be, you know, if they still want to have an empire, they'll probably be able to squash us like bugs because they'll be so, you know, so smart and so advanced. He's like, but maybe those desires won't even seem desirable to them when they've achieved this genomic ideal. And then similarly, exactly as you guys were saying, you know, he's wondering, does he seem human to them because of his visible physical differences and disabilities? And then we also have the Ba, whom we haven't really talked about, but the Ba are this kind of, you know, genderless, literally like the perfect race of servants. Like they build, you know, these Ba to serve them, to be loyal to them.
And to practice their genetics on.
Yeah. Right. Which is
tested out.
Mm-hmm. Extremely disturbing. But then, you know, we come to find out that the Ba are somewhat complex too. I mean, the only kind of like significant Ba character, you know, it dies basically like quite early on, but yet there's a lot of discussion of, you know, what was the Ba Lura thinking? What was going on in the Ba Lura's mind? Are the Ba these perfect servants, or do they have their own motivations and desires and goals? So I think this notion of, you know, who is human and who counts as human, and by what measure do we recognize someone else as human, are all kind of, at least they start to be explored in this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's a lot of very different perspectives in this book about power and about, you know, literal humanity. Because you have the Hote and the Ba and the Gem. And all three are, they're all tied together in a way that I find really impressive. You know, this is a really, she's gone from having the warrior class, the Gem, who are the Barayaran's enemies, to this really complicated social system in which the Haute are doing one thing, the Gem are doing another thing, and the Ba are doing maybe something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that the difference in perspectives, the perspective keeps changing, I think is what I'm trying to get at. You know, every time Miles learns something new, his perspective has to change. And his perspective on humanity, his own humanity and their humanity, and recognizing them as human, not just as the enemy.
Yeah, and you know, I think his like sort of helpless love for Ryan Dagdyar is definitely part of that, right? That they're not just the enemy. They're not like kind of the blank, faceless villains that the Cetagandans have been, you know, for like, I mean, like in the Vor game, you know, which comes right before this, it's just like, oh, the Cetagandans, like they don't even really appear except for as this like massive space force. Like they're just sort of dots on blinking dots on a comm console, yeah. Right? They're not people. And so then we have this, you know, great sort of exploration of them as people.
Yeah. Well, and I think Bujold gives her world that space to expand because they were, she was like, okay, Cetagandans, they're the bad guys. Several books, they can be the bad guys, like, right? They were, after the Time of Isolation, they were the invaders. And then in Ethan of Ethos, they're just these bad guys who have these bad motivations. And she recognizes that's not really how people are. Like, there's not anyone out there who's just a bad guy. And so she gives us an entire book to give us that backstory. So I love that she does that.
And I also like how she really elaborates on the fragility of this political system, because, you know, I mean, I honestly don't, as many times as I've read this book, I still don't know that I totally grasp, like, what is keeping the Haute on top? Why, I mean, is it just sort of social conditioning? Like, why don't the Gem just do whatever they want?
It's a good question. But I think it is social conditioning. I think that they're indoctrinated from, you know, their birth as little gemlings to honor the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And if not necessarily the Haute, the emperor, because that's one of the things that they talk about at the end is what the emperor represents as opposed to what the Haute represent, and they're not the same thing.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and Miles can't take that next step to ask himself, well, why are the Vor on top? Right.
Right.
Like he can't manage. He's like, well, we're the military people, so of course we're on top. But he doesn't quite manage to see that this system he's looking at in Cetaganda is something that maybe he could self-reflect on, even with even with Cordelia as his mother, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's so many ways in which Beriar and Cetaganda's imperial systems are totally different, but there's also, you know, ways in which they're not that different, actually, that they're, you know, the imperial expansionism, the, you know, these strong class barriers, which are often resented by people. There does seem to be a lot more drama in Beriar over like trying to overthrow the emperor.
That's true. Like
the Cetagandan like emperor seems pretty solid.
Yeah.
I don't know enough Cetagandan history to really compare.
I mean, he has the advantage of not coming to the throne when he's 5.
Yeah, true. Also true.
Very true.
So, but I think it is interesting the way that both empires, and again, this is where I think my interest turned into the Goblin Emperor, was the single person who's at the center of the wheel, you know, Gregor or Fletcher. And I don't know how to pronounce his last name because I've never heard these books on audio.
Well, Grover Gardner says Gyaja. I actually did some research and I think it probably should be pronounced Jaja, but we can say it however we want.
Yes, that's very true. that when you finally, you know, this is, I guess, another way to think about this book is as a circular maze, that Miles is working his way in from the outside and, you know, false dead ends and false trails, but he's getting slowly closer and closer and closer to the center of Sitagandan society, which is the emperor. And that's when, and when he gets there, I mean, I think he finds someone who's more like Gregor than any random Sitagandan is like any random Bariyaran.
And you know, Fletcher Gaja is he is smart, he is savvy, he's strategic. The fact at the end he gives this medal, right? Which is, I mean, it's really clever, and they make it really clear in the book why it's so clever. But basically, Sitaganda and Bariyar are the ultimate enemies. They are generational, you know, on opposing sides of the conflict. And they've given Miles their highest honor. So he can't walk home and be like, look at my, you know, award that I've gotten from Sitaganda for what a great service I did to the Sitagandan Empire, because it makes him seem like a traitor to Bariyar. So it's, I mean, it's just so funny. And then one of my favorite parts of this book is like at the very end, Miles is like kind of sitting there with his medal and he's like, oh, I don't really care about it. And then Ivan's like, oh, I'll just throw it away then. And Miles is like, no, that's my medal. Give it back.
He's like, it's my first medal, you know? Yeah. You can't get rid of it.
That may be another reason why the Hoat stay on top, is that they are very, very good at social engineering.
Yes.
Because they social engineer Miles to perfection.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. They knew exactly what to do.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the Gem Colonel is like, at first I thought you would like it, and now I think you will hate it.
Yes. So funny. One thing that I think is interesting, though, is that the bad guys think that Ivan is the one who's sort of plotting everything.
Right.
They are very, they're always trying to use someone to sort of as a tool, right? So that they can kind of keep their hands clean and stay behind the scenes. So they use Yanaro, they use the Ba, you know, they use these various characters as tools to enact their plot. And so they see Miles running around, you know, I mean, he literally like goes up to like all of his suspects and just like drops some bombs just to like see what's going to happen. So they see Miles running around, you know, doing all of these active things, and they think, oh, well, clearly he's the tool. So Ivan must be the brains behind the operation. But of course, you know, they're also going to be prejudiced by Miles' physical appearance, right? You know, just like Barry Aaron's in that way. And so they can't even conceive that Miles would actually be the brain. So they knock Ivan out first because they think that that will stop this, you know, opposition. Right.
But I mean, it's also interesting because Ivan's whole strategy is, like, I'm not going to put myself out there. I'm not going to put myself in the limelight so people won't think that I'm the dangerous one. And of course, that backfires here on Sitaganda as well. So just fascinating.
Well, they kind of out-twisted themselves. You know what I mean? It's a very twisted sort of approach. And they took it one twist too far. Like, actually, it was more like what it seemed than not what it seemed. Yes. All right, shall we talk about wider Vorkosigan references?
Let's do it.
Okay, well, I already alluded to some of these characters are going to recur very briefly in a civil campaign. So we will see a couple of them briefly come back at the end. Yes.
There is a reference to Terran C.
So. One thing that is not actually a wider reference, but I feel like the ending is so like, you know, Miles is like, Fletcher and I aren't done with each other. But like they are. There's no... You know, there's no like Fletcher Miles face off book, and I want there to be.
There's no face off book, but I do think there's this sort of evolution, because of course the medal does reappear in a different book.
True.
And there is a re-encounter with the Empire in a different book as well. So maybe there's an evolution of Miles, young Miles thinking there's going to be a face-off and middle-aged Miles realizing we don't have to fight, you know? Right? So.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I really hadn't thought about it that way.
And then, of course, Ivan will get his own book.
Yes.
Yeah. And Ivan, I think, really in the next several books where he appears, just becomes, so it's going to be a couple of episodes before we get back to Ivan until we get to Brothers in Arms. Yes. But in Brothers in Arms and in Mirror Dance, like, and in Memory, there's a lot of growth for Ivan. So I do feel like this is the first book where he becomes more than a caricature.
Yes.
And he really gets developed. And we don't actually get Ivan's POV for quite a while. Like I don't know what, do you know what is the first Ivan POV?
It's in A Civil Campaign.
We don't get Ivan's POV ever before A Civil Campaign?
Mm.
Is it not in Memory?
No. Memory is entirely Miles.
Okay.
All right. Well, but we still learn a lot about him, which is very
true. We do. Exactly. I really feel like Gujold was like, okay, I'm going to develop him. And then she was like, okay, he's finally ready for the limelight in A Civil Campaign.
And Ivan is like, no, please.
He's like, no, I'm good.
Please keep me out of the limelight. Yeah. Ivan. Love Ivan. All right. And so our last thing that we always talk about is the title, which is Seed of Ganda.
Yes.
Well chosen.
Yes. Very well chosen. Yes. I mean, this is the second book named after a planet. First one was Beriar. It makes sense that they would do that. She would choose Seed of Ganda as the next planet.
Planetary named book. Yes, it does, because of their sort of like oppositional relationship. And I think that Seed of Ganda and being in Seed of Ganda can give us kind of a new way of thinking about Beriar and thinking about the society of Beriar. And we do spend like some time in other places in some of the earlier books, right? We spend a little time on Beta Colony. We spend a little time, you know, here and there. But this is the first time where we see, I think, a full different society fully developed. And we see, you know, the ways in which it's developed in certain directions and the ways in which Beriar has developed in other very different directions. And it does kind of shine, I think, some lights on some of the not that the, you know, the Seed of Ganda Empire is perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it definitely shines a light, I think, on some of the problems of Beriar that Bujold is interested in, their treatment of women and their perspective of women being one for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, the way Beriar views genes, right? Because on Beriar, like genetic mutation, which all that means is a change in your genes, is horrifying. Whereas on Seed of Ganda, a genetic mutation is desirable. It's an art form.
Yeah, it's the ultimate goal.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, right. They're trying to mutate themselves away from the sort of base humanity that Beriar is frantically trying to not mutate away from.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So having Seed of Ganda, I think, teaches us about Beriar, you know, in a kind of weird, tilted way.
Yes, I think it does. I think she couldn't have picked a better title. Mm-hmm. Because there is no other way to encapsulate mm-hmm. everything that happens in this book.
Right, right. Absolutely, because the project isn't just let's solve this mystery, it's let's figure out Seed of Ganda and how Seed of Ganda works as much as Miles can being an outsider. And I like that there are some things kind of left open, because I do think if you go and try to like encounter another culture, there are many things that you're not going to understand as an outsider to that culture that you can't grasp from your
perspective.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much, Catherine. Really appreciated your coming on.
Well, thank you. I had a good time.
Yes, of course. And if someone wants to find you on the internet, where should they look?
They should look at www.catherineaddison.com.
There you go. And Alex, as always, my intrepid co-host, where can they find you?
You can find me on my website, alexandravasti.com, on Instagram or TikTok. And, you know, on all the rest of the episodes of this podcast as well.
Yes. And if you're interested in other episodes of Plot Trysts, you can always find us on Instagram at Plot Trysts. Our WordPress site is Plot Trysts, and then Goodreads/Plot Trysts. Thank you so much.